Welcome to We Are Technologies User Friendly with host Bill Sickens, technology architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. We've got a great show for you today. We've got live coverage of XRDC, the world standard for virtual reality, augmented reality for developers, and some of the different topics that comes out of that. We got a book review for you today and one of our great Q&A sections. So don't go away. Here we go. What's in the news today?
Pixel 4 phone announced.
All right, so it's that time of year. Last month was the Apple iPhone 11, and that announcement and the product that's come from that is looking to be very, very good. It's one of the best upgrades, or considered to be one of the best upgrades Apple has done. And now it's time for Google to be putting up their upgrades, and they have announced the Pixel 4. And the best way that I can describe this new phone is they've done an absolutely incredible job on upgrading the camera. What they have in there is phenomenal, and something that's just as incredible as the Apple iPhone 11, but they kind of forgot about the rest of the device. Most of the specs on the rest of it are the same as the Pixel 3 XL was. There's no 3.5-inch headphone jack like we had in the past on that, and most of the memory in those configurations have been tweaked a little bit, but there's not a lot of updates there. In my opinion, unless you specifically need the features that are in the camera, go for a 3 XL or a 3, depending on the screen size you want. They've lowered the price on them. They almost do the same thing.
Google announces many new smart devices.
So at their show, in addition to the phone, they did a bunch of other stuff. And they're coming out with some different products. A lot of it has to do with the Nest ecosystem. For Google Nest, they have some different smart speakers, a mini and a Wi-Fi.
So are these all home-based items?
Yeah, most of these would be home-based items. These are like your... Okay. Your Amazon Echo, that kind of an idea, just some different options in that space. One of the other ones that I did think was interesting was the Pixel Buds, which are earbuds for the competition to like the Apple headset that we're seeing from Amazon now, a version of that too. And the other one that I did think was interesting was the Pixel Book Go. And it's based on the idea of the what was a Chromebook, which is kind of a mini laptop. It's for basic functions. So if your purpose is going to get on to browse the web, check email, stuff like that, one of these lighter, newer, cheaper computers might be for you. Doesn't do as much as a full laptop. It's certainly not a desktop replacement, but it is a new entry into the market. It's entering at $650, and they are taking pre-orders for them now.
Wow. Okay. Here's one that's kind of different. McDonald's accepts job applications through smart speakers. I find this kind of strange. So can you explain that?
Yeah. So this is something where they're trying to embrace. It's for the millennials primarily, at least that's what they said in their press release on it, is the idea that you can start a job application through your smart speaker. Now, Jeremy, what did you find out about this?
Okay. You start your job application through the speaker. It doesn't give me the direct commands for it, but it apparently asks you several questions that you respond to out loud. And then it texts you a link to finish the application online. So they're obviously going for more interaction with AIs and stuff than just go to the website and fill out the thing.
Right, right. The name of the product that they've come up with is Apply Through, kind of like drive through, but apply through. So it isn't the complete process, but it does get you started. So, you know, something definitely worth checking out.
Well, McDonald's has been innovating or trying to, so we'll see how this turns out.
Yeah, another new product out there. I understand they're partnering with DoorDash and doing some other things too. So trying to move into 2019. Technology, especially at something like a developers conference, brings along solutions to try to solve problems. And one of the things that we deal with as developers, which is a little bit of an advanced concept, is the idea of version control. And Gretchen, what does that mean to you?
Well, version control will help to, it's when you have a group of people working all on the same product or project, whatever you want to call it, and everybody's contributing, but what if somebody adds or does something that just isn't any good? Well, if you have different versions saved, you can get rid of the version that had the item that screwed up the batch. You can go back. If you don't have that, then there's no way to repair or easily fix a situation. And I think that's what version control really is.
Collaboration is definitely a big part of it. And our interview here is from a company called Plastic that has come up to an innovative solution to this problem.
This is Francisco Monteverde from Coddy Software, the company behind Plastic SCM, a version control for developers of any kind.
So let's start with the basics. What is version control and how does that work in software?
Okay, version control is an essential collaboration tool for any team of developers, even one, that keeps all the evolution of the code, keep all the versions that you do, and have tools to compare current versions with older versions, what changes are, and also allows you to work different members of a group to work in parallel, and is able to merge all the changes into a single release.
Now, some of our listeners, and I know we've worked with products like Git and Bitbucket, how does this compare to that, and what's different, and what's the same?
Yeah, so we created the product from ground up since 2005, so exactly the same time that Linus Torvalds came up with Git.
Right.
It took us 5 years, even Git, to get mainstream in the marketplace. Basically, the difference between us and Git is, well, we are a commercial company. We do everything that Git does, distributed version control, but also we do centralized. And you might wonder, why do you want to do centralized and distributed? Since distributed is what the people demand.
Right.
So when you come to a conference like this, virtual reality, games, large binary assets, they need to work in centralized. You don't want to replicate or have a repo with terabytes of information in your PC replicating all the teams. So you need tools that mix centralized and distributed. Distributed for developers, centralized for artists, and a specific workflow for them to make things easier.
Now, I can understand where this would be of a great benefit.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
So absolutely. With centralized development, you wouldn't branch and all of that kind of stuff. You'd have a, how would that work?
I mean, people confused centralized with no branching. You can actually do the branches in the centralized.
Okay.
You can do that.
I would have been one of those people.
Yeah. You might want to work not having a replicated repo and do your branches in the central server. So it's nothing to do with that. It means that being centralized, what it means is all the files are in the central server. You don't need to have a local repo. You work exactly with the things that you need to work. If you're an artist, you might want to work with one asset, not a whole repository of assets. If you are a developer, you might want to be consistent and have all the files to be able to compile. So in that case, you replicate.
Is it still a checkout process like
exactly,
you would?
Okay. Exactly.
Now,
yeah.
I've used Bitbucket, and it's very difficult to use. Would you say yours is easier, user-friendly?
Yes, it is. It is because it's graphical. It has a graphical user interface and easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
We have what we call the Branch Explorer, which is like a timeline and shows you how is the code evolving.
Okay.
So easy to understand, but I recognize that most of the developers, they don't understand what Git means, version control means. So today we need to evangelize how the people might use version control much better. I mean,
okay.
Much of the people
yeah.
say, well, I use Git, but they don't use, I mean, they use 10% of Git power, probably.
So let me ask you that question then. If you were working with a software company that's putting together version control and going to work on a project, where would their starting point be? Because most of the time you just commit your code and then kind of check it out. And I know that doesn't use anywhere near the capabilities of these type of products.
But I would start with the process. I mean, train the people is the important thing. What people, what profile, what do they need? I mean, and then secondly is the process of development. What version control does, and specifically the distributed version control board branching, is I compare that with the cook in the 3-star Michelin. Okay, you cannot imagine cooking just in one pot, everybody in a single pot. That's what used to be version control. Everybody dropping everything in there. So if you put something wrong in it, everybody smell that thing. Who put this in there?
Right.
So by working in parallel, it means like a 3-star Michelin, you cook in a pan, you cook in an oven, you boil this separately, you test it, and finally you put the wonderful dish with every single part of the cook. Really, really well done, well tested, and then it's perfect. That's the way. So you need to work on the process to work that way in branching. And then merging, doing the right dish, merging with the chef, and do exactly the test that you need to do. So it's not the technology, it's actually the processes to build that.
And that makes sense. So I'm going to ask a geeky question because this is something that I run into. Does your product integrate with things like AWS pipelines? And because this is where I've had, I know personally, a lot of issues because you can't get the two to talk to each other very well.
No, we don't integrate with AWS pipeline, if I recall. No, we don't. There's going to be specifics about it. Right. Probably there are customers that integrate, but we don't do that out of the box. But we integrate with things like Jenkins, Bamboo, with...
So you're a lower level. It integrates actually then in that component and not the hosting component.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That makes more sense.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Cool.
Exactly.
So how does somebody find you online?
Well, plasticscm.com.
Okay.
Plasticscm.com.
PlasticSCM.com, and we'll put that on our social media. And thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you, too.
This is User-Friendly 2.0, plastic, version control, all of these topics that programmers have to worry about. We'll have some more interviews after the break. Welcome back. This is User-Friendly 2.0. We are recording live at XDRC, the virtual reality conference held in San Francisco every year. Jeremy, Gretchen, what do you think of the show so far?
I've enjoyed the show. It's been pretty fun checking out all the cool stuff that people are doing for VR and AR.
And this is definitely something for the high-end developer, focused on the high professionals.
Absolutely. And that being said, we're going to have an interview here in just a little bit from a company called Donuts. And they sell what are called TLDs, or top-level domains, which is what that acronym stands for. And we've seen these on the internet as long as there's been an internet, mainly in the idea of .com, .org, .edu, and so on. But that's being expanded. Jeremy, what do you think of what you saw?
Well, their list of names available was pretty comprehensive. And I experienced some of the name stuff a couple of years ago, when a webcomic guy I follow had Walmart.horse, and Walmart forced him to sell it.
Right. Okay. So, and brand protection is very important, especially when you have a lot of extensions. So what we're specifically talking about is other things than .com, and very focused ones like, I don't know what it would be, .podcast, I guess would be one like it, right?
.games, .live, .news.
.show,
yeah,
.lawyer.
There was a lot of them.
All right. And here we go to the interview.
All right, I'm here at the XRDC with Blake Gomez, who is selling a variety of different domain names. Now, you may have heard of .com, .org, those type of things, but it looks like this is expanding well beyond that. Welcome to the show.
Hey, William. Nice to be with you.
Tell me a little bit about what you're doing.
So I'm with Donuts. We are the owners and operators of over 250 top-level domain names. And so again, you're familiar with .com, .net, .org. The reason that everyone's familiar with that is for the better part of the last 15 years, those were really the only options available. So the introduction of having now hundreds and hundreds of top-level domain names that are not just alternatives to .com, they actually have real meaning in them. And they can be leveraged the same way that any sort of traditional keyword.com has been leveraged for brand marketing, for SEO.
So this would be like mydomain.cash or something like that, right?
Exactly.
So how does this work? You go on and register your domain name, or is there a different process? Or
that's the same process, the same way you would register any domain name. In fact, most of our domain names are actually retailed through the companies you know about, like GoDaddy.com. Like Google.domains, which is also a great example of Google actually leaning into to using a top-level domain name.
Now, are you finding out people are moving to this format a little bit more, and do people get to them? Because you would know just to put in .com, but it seems like with some of the new names, it might not occur to the end user that it's just this works the same way.
Right, yeah. This has been something that I think a lot of people may have not been paying attention to. But now you're seeing folks like Google and like GoDaddy actually doing a great job of marketing these names to the end users and helping them to understand the opportunity of being able to leverage the keywords that completely left to right.
Right. Now, if someone wanted to register one of these TLD, your top-level domain extensions, that's a little more complicated, right?
Yes. That process, the window has closed on that. That was 5 years ago now that ICANN opened up the round and allowed people to apply to run their own top-level domain registries. And that's when you saw folks like us coming in and making a very sort of taking a big position. But that's also when you saw Google come in and apply to run over 80 top-level domain names, including .app, which is now out and popular, and .dev and .new. If you want to do something kind of cool, go to the top of your URL browser and type in something like doc.new or slide.new or see, website.new, any of these will actually trigger, you know, a Google application just to pop up. And so what we're going to see even in the not-so-distant future is brands like Twitter leaning in and using Google's top-level domain. So if you want to compose a new tweet, you simply go to the top of the URL bar and type in tweet.new.
Okay, so that seems, and you wouldn't put a .com after it. You would just use that extension.
That's correct.
Okay, and how does the cost structure work for all of this?
They're pretty much, you know, as long as they're, it's an available name,
right?
You'll find it to be very considerable to what you would pay for, you know, most domain names or domain names right now. So ranging anywhere between maybe $10 and $30.
Now, do you still run into people that buy them and hoard them and resell them like you do with the .coms?
You know, not as much, only because it's a tougher thing to want to speculate on. .com was sort of easy to speculate on because there was really only one option, right? So it became, what are the keyword combinations that you can get for that one option? Speculators, I think, struggle to speculate across what is now hundreds and hundreds of options. It's hard to want to hoard, but that doesn't mean that, you know, that there aren't still a lot of great names that form natural phrases that are still out there, that are still available.
And, you know, that's one other question I did want to ask you. We talked about this a little bit more before going on air, is the idea of brand management and brand protection. And people can hire companies like yours to deal with that, from what I understand.
That's true. That's true. There's kind of a different side of our business, but we do. We have a lot of products for brand protection. You know, namely DPML is what is our product that allows brands to control or to protect their brand name across the entire suite of TLDs. So folks like, you know, say Apple have the ability to, you know, restrict any registration of Apple.news,
Apple.whatever. So you could buy the front part of it, or, well, the back part of it, and, and be able to keep that across the board, which makes sense for a lot of these bigger companies, it seems like. All right, how does somebody find you online?
You know, they can find us either by going to donuts.domains. I mean, that's our homepage. But for the most part, if you want to look for available names, I would recommend name.com or GoDaddy or
just the normal registers and just find the extensions. Yeah. Is there a master list of extensions anywhere?
You know, I think you could actually find that on ICANN's website. But for the most part, I would just encourage you to go to the search bar on any domain name provider, anywhere you register names, and just start experimenting. Start, you know, putting in keywords that are valuable to you, valuable to your business, and see what comes back. And you're going to be surprised by the availability that's there.
And see what's out there, because there's a lot of them. Blake, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Well, it's amazing to me how these things are expanding, and I think it's going to be interesting to be able to register beyond just .com.
Absolutely.
I agree, yeah.
All right, this is User Friendly 2.0. After the break, we're going to have our Q&A. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. What questions do we have this week?
Well, our first one is, what is the difference between Wi-Fi and a mesh network? Is mesh wired? I've never heard of a mesh.
Well, there you go.
Explain it.
Actually, this is a new type of technology that they have been marketing for a while now. So it's not new. It's been out there, but it's a upgrade, I would say. I'm trying to think of the right word. It's not a replacement for Wi-Fi, but it's an augmentation.
Okay.
And what it is basically a set of repeaters. They usually come in what are called pods. And what happens is you still have your Wi-Fi router and all of that, and you plug one pod either wired or wirelessly into the router right next to it, depending on the technology. And then you have the other ones that you can spread throughout your house or office. The idea with this being is it acts as a repeater for the Wi-Fi. So if you have a dead zone in your house, this would be a way to get around that dead zone.
So is that like the little thing that we have in our hallway?
It's that kind of an idea. Now, since the audience won't know what you have in your hallway, that's a little pod thing.
Yeah.
So is it a pod or what?
Yeah, that is a form of a pod. Now, yours has USB ports so that you can hardwire or plug stuff into it. It also has an Ethernet port, and some of them have that as well. They also had a device in the past called a bridge, which is similar, but the pods are repeaters and you can have more than one.
Oh, well, that's kind of cool.
So
our next question is it possible to have a smart speaker in my car?
Well, this is something that I have been trying to work out for the last couple of years. And the answer to this is yes. Now, up until very recently, I was playing with an Alexa Echo device, or a Dot, I think is what I was actually using, and trying to get it set up in the car. And I actually did get it to work with a Wi-Fi tether on my phone. But there was a great amount of time being taken for startup every time you started the car and that type of thing. And the companies are starting to get an idea with this. And Amazon has recently released a device called Alexa Audio. And that is a smart
speaker. You
mean Auto? Auto, yes. And that's a smart speaker that's actually designed to go in your car and work with the car. So I've been playing with that recently, and it seems to work very well. So the short answer to this is yes. The other way that you can do this, of course, is using the assistant in your phone, which will have the same effect and work over your Bluetooth. But there are ways that you can now get up, set up and dedicate a smart speaker.
What is a good kid's Star Wars costume for Halloween?
Well, I don't know, Gretchen. What is a good kid's Star Wars costume for Halloween?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of up to the kid.
I think the parameters here from this question was sent in is something that would be easy to put together for a younger child, something that if they get dirty wouldn't be an absolute catastrophe to clean, that kind of a thing.
Okay, a Jawa.
A Jawa? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of it depends on if you're going to make it or if you're going to buy it. If you're going to make it and you have some skill with the sewing machine, you can make any costume you want. It depends on what the kid wants. You can make a homemade Darth Vader or the Emperor or Luke or Han Solo. You could make a
Princess Leia.
It depends on what you want to make and what the kid wants too.
Yeah, it's really up to the child. Now, I would think harder costumes would be something like Greedo.
Things that require a full mask that you can't easily make.
Yeah.
And something like my Wookiee suit, you wouldn't want to necessarily do that. But it does sound like some things are probably a little easier than others to put together.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, they sell a lot of costumes for kids, so you'd almost maybe have to try it on.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing is if there's like robes, you know, where things drag, you might want to either shorten them or maybe not pick those kind of costumes if your child is not coordinated for walking around. Right. Yeah, 'cause kids can trip on stuff. I mean, as adults, we can trip on things. But as adults, we tend to know, I'm going to do that, while kids might just be excited and not think about it.
You know, and from my standpoint, a black robe's better than a brown one, so it's definitely better to go as a Sith than a Jedi. And if you have to make
bias much, jeez.
Not at all, not at all. What's our next question?
What is a Chromebook? Do I still need a laptop?
This is actually a good technical question, and this is something that's come up a few times. A Chromebook is actually a version of a laptop in a way. So the answer to this really comes down to what you're planning to do with it. If you're like most users and you're going on to browse the web, check your email, stuff like that, then a Chromebook would work just fine for you. And they're a lot less money. The battery life tends to be a lot longer and they're simpler so they don't break down as much. But if you're doing advanced things like video editing or Photoshop, those kind of functions, or if you're coding like I do, then you still actually do need a full computer or a laptop, desktop replacement type thing. The other thing of it is, if you're doing VR, then you would also need a more powerful computer than a Chromebook. But a Chromebook is great for something light to carry with you, to be able to deal with getting on your email and just doing the normal things where you would browse a web. We will be back after the break. This is User Friendly 2.0. Welcome back to User Friendly. It is amazing to me how much material in popular culture exists beyond the movies or beyond the television show. And there are full-on novels about most of the franchises we all like. And Jeremy and Gretchen, I understand you have a Star Wars book.
Oh, actually, we have lots of Star Wars books.
I've seen them. I've moved them. I know.
Yeah. Well, we're only going to talk about two of them.
We're going to talk about two of them. All right. So go ahead and tell us what you got.
All right. Well, today we have two different books. They're both Star Wars. The one I'll be talking about is Star Wars Revan. And this is from the Old Republic time period. And it's also part of the Legends series.
My book is also part of the Legends series. It's a current series, but it's still Legends because it is Darth Plagueis.
So what makes Legends Legends? Let's throw that in real quick.
Legends is no longer canon.
And what does that mean?
That means it's not part of the official Star Wars story. It's backstory that may or may not be accurate.
Okay.
And this is also something, you just brought up something that it's a Disney thing recently. And so there's a lot of ennui about this.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, ennui is a good word.
Yeah, there we are.
I like that word. And that's very accurate for this.
But these are still really, really good books. So whether they're legends or they're canon, they're still good and they're worth the time. So Jeremy, tell me a little bit about Darth Plagueis.
Okay, as we know, Darth Plagueis is the master of Darth Sidious, who is the Emperor or Chancellor Palpatine, or however you want to call it. So he's the one who recruited Senator, or actually at the time he was just Palpatine. He was kind of in the legislative program on Naboo, working towards being a senator. But he wasn't a senator yet. And we get the backstory of how Plagueis manipulated everything up to and including the point of his death. So we learn all the secrets of the Sith, all the things that he knew that he taught Darth Sidious, and we understand why everything works the way it works following Plagueis' death. So, you know, it's a great series. It's Darth Plagueis, Star Wars Legends by James Luceno. I hope I'm saying that right. But I really enjoyed this book. It covers the 35 years of Plagueis and Sidious. It's amazing. The writing is really good. It includes a lot of secrets. There's all things that they cover that you thought about, like, oh, hey, I wonder if, oh, yeah, there it is right there.
Well, these are very rich characters. The backstory that I just know from the movie and cosplaying Palpatine, it's a lot of fun to do. So it's like this is a way to really be able to get some more information on your favorite characters.
And so some of these characters are very intricately woven into the tapestry of the reality of the Star Wars universe. I mean, they're not flat stereotypes. They're complicated.
Yes. We learn in this Darth Plagueis book, Plagueis was a master of manipulating the midichlorians.
Right.
Well.
And midichlorians are what gives you the Force, right? So
it gives you access to the Force.
Yeah, okay.
It's supposedly. Here's the way, he didn't, it's not just, oh, he was a master. It talks in this book about years of experiments. Of all these different things that he did to try and figure out how he could, if he could influence the midichlorians, and eventually what happened when he did.
Right. Right.
It's, you know, like, oh, well, oh, okay. So he's not just some guy. He does all these things to benefit himself and the Sith in general, but mostly himself.
Right.
And, you know, that's a Sith thing. That's what they do.
Right. So, yeah, we've learned that that character is definitely.
It's, you know, I definitely recommend this book.
Good. I haven't gotten a chance to read it, but it's on my list. So I've been doing research on Star Wars for quite a while because I've been working on my own books. And I thought, well, everybody talks about this Darth Revan guy. And I'm sorry if I'm not saying the name right. I know Bill Snodgrass is going to go, oh, no, that's not how you say his name. That's okay.
Bill Snodgrass is our editor and producer and one of the people that keeps us sane on all of this. One of the many people.
And the thing is that may be because I've never played the video games.
No, I haven't either.
And so that brings up a whole new topic. There's a lot of stories woven within the video game world.
Right.
So anyways, I thought I wanted to find out more about this character. And he's actually a Jedi. But I thought he was mostly a Sith. But he's a Jedi and a Sith, you know, and he switches back and forth. And so in the end, you kind of realize that he understands both sides of the Force, the dark and the light.
Right.
So he's kind of really the ideal guy who is balanced. This has some other characters that are very Sith-based that are fascinating, like Lord Scourge?
Scourge? Yes, Scourge.
Scourge. Okay.
I don't know.
That I liked him. I thought he was fascinating. And the end of the book is a shocker. it's unexpected, and I won't tell you.
Yeah, we won't give it away, but you have got to read it to find out now.
So, Drew Carpathian, I'm sorry, I keep saying your name wrong. Maybe someday we'll run into you at a Comic Con or something, and you can tell us how we're supposed to pronounce your name.
Perhaps the Force will make that happen.
Yeah, that's it. So this is also a book I would recommend, especially if you are a fan of those video games. These characters are not flat stereotypes, and
we've seen Darth Revan cosplayers all over the place.
Oh yeah,
there's lots of them. It's not like there's only one.
Surprised one at one of the Comic Cons. He turned on his lightsaber behind me, and I turned around, and I don't think he was expecting to see Darth Nihilus.
And Darth Nihilus is a video game character too,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And I've done quite a bit of research as I can on him. And he's only in the video game. And if you don't own the video game, it's really hard to get good details about him.
There's actually a rumor out there that there might be a reboot on that video game, too. So as we find more about that, we'll certainly
In HD, that would be pretty intense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The video game you're talking about is Knights of the Old Republic. And it's one that came out, 15 years ago or something for the PC. PC classic.
And they often call it KOTOR.
Yeah. And it was a great game. I mean, it was an absolutely incredible game. But by today's standards on computer technology, it doesn't have the same graphic sets and things that we're used to, but it's definitely worth playing. So how does one get these books?
I got this at Barnes & Noble. Okay. You probably could find them like at Powell's, maybe used.
Right. Amazon.
Amazon, yeah.
Online, in-store, any place you can find a book.
So we've got about a minute to go here. So tell us a little bit about why you have fun reading these books.
Because they give us a deeper depth of who the characters are.
Yeah, we get so much more knowledge base on the backstory and how everybody interacts. Gretchen mentioned the tapestry. Everything is interwoven. You can't have one without the other. I mean, we've heard Sidious mention Darth Plagueis the Wise. He in the book, he talks about that, and he's joking, I think, as he says it.
Right.
And so then later, after he's killed his master, we find out all these things, why he says that, how it's true. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The richness of the depth is just, it's something we have to understand. If you want to know more, if you're content with just the surface details, that's fine.
And there are many Star Wars fans out there, or I know of which we are all one. So it actually makes a lot of sense to be able to get into it this way. All right, this is user friendly, and this sounds like a really cool set of books to read. Let us know if you do and what you think of them. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. Great show today, guys.
Yeah, I would say so.
So let's take a little bit, since we have a little bit of time here, and talk about some of the other things that happened. We had a little bit of drama on this trip covering the show. We were there through an earthquake and an explosion.
and a major freeway being closed.
Yeah. And from what I understand, they're still thinking that the earthquake might have caused the explosion. So what happened? And these are all the things you run into. Whether it's a Comic-Con or a technology show, whenever you travel, there can be some surprises. And we definitely ran into that a little bit. The first night, there was a 4.5 earthquake that felt pretty strong where we were.
Yeah, it shook the place pretty good.
And then the next day, we were back at the XDRC convention, and we hear that there was a refinery explosion up by Vallejo.
We could see it. We could see the black smoke from San Francisco.
So we had decided we had finished for the day and head back, and I'm glad we did, because like you said, they closed a major freeway. We ended up having to go back through kind of a weird route anyway, which would have even been more difficult if we had gone later.
Yeah. So
you always want to think about these things. But outside of the drama of those two instances, which I'm glad no one got hurt and there was no real lasting damage, other than they're probably going to use it as an excuse to push gas prices up down there for a while. I think I really enjoyed the show. Now, one thing is how different the production was. And what I mean by that is normally a tech show is either in a convention center or a hotel type setting, you know, these type of things. This was very different. And Gretchen, tell us about what we found.
Okay, I really had, I actually liked the setting. It was like a warehouse for shipping. Mm-hmm. And we think it was probably once a military shipping facility.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very clever use of such a building. And I think it made it where it wasn't like you were all closed off. You know, you didn't lose people hidden away in secluded little rooms like you would at a convention center.
Right.
But one of the disadvantages that I noticed is that they didn't have good enough signage on the outside of where they were located. Because when we came in, we did the typical Google mapping thing. And it directed us to go to a completely different area of this facility. And this facility, I think, was a historical location where they had multiple venues mm-hmm. where people could have events. And there was a park and everything.
Yeah, lots of different buildings and parking areas.
And well, so we had no idea where we were going.
The location is Fort Mason, which is a state park in California right there by San Francisco. And I think it's 19 acres. I might be wrong on that number, but it is a large park, especially for one that's in the city. So Google Maps took us right to the front door, but we had to find our way in. That was the one criticism I had there too. But outside of that, I think the show was really good. I really enjoyed it. And we'll look forward to covering more things like that in future weeks. This is User Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User Friendly 2.0 is copyright 2019 User Friendly Media Group, Inc. The views and opinions expressed in this show are those of the host and not necessarily User Friendly Media Group, Inc. or this station. Music licensing by BMI. Hosting provided by WeAreTechnology.com. Podcast available at theanswerportland.com or userfriendlyshow.com.